This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices Hot Topics, episode number 11, was recorded on March 23rd, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This special episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by my own vacation rental property on the coast of Maine. Tourist season is looking like a write-off at this point, so I'm looking for a tenant who wants to escape from New York, so to speak, and needs a big home in the countryside to ride out the COVID-19 crisis outside the city. I'll tell you all about it at the end of today's podcast. Joining me today are Lenore Hawkins, global macro strategist for Tematica Research, reporting from Ground Zero in northern Italy, and Dr. Steve Bickel, a medical doctor in northeastern Florida and a very longtime Macro Voices listener and supporter. I want to start with the boots on the ground updates from both of our guests. Lenore, you're talking to us today from Lake Como in northern Italy, pretty much right at the center of the crisis. The situation in Italy seems to, at least from the statistics that we're seeing, seems to be getting worse, with over 6,500 new cases reported on Saturday, almost 800 new deaths on Saturday. We're even seeing headlines, Zero Hedge is reporting martial law has been imposed in Italy. Please give us a firsthand report. What's going on there? Is martial law really an accurate description of what's happening? And how does what we see in the news compare to what's actually happening around you on the ground there in Italy?
We do have martial law to some degree. And by the way, for everyone who uses Twitter, be very careful when you type martial law, because Twitter will auto-correct it to the incorrect spelling if you don't pay attention. We are essentially under martial law. On Saturday night, Conte got on, of all things, Facebook, Prime Minister Conte, and announced that all industry that is deemed non-essential would be completely shut down. Unfortunately, he announced this before they were able to put together the list of just what that means. And also, all activity outside the home that is not absolutely essential is no longer allowed, which means I cannot go out for a walk. I cannot go out for a run. And when I did try to do it, police stopped me and sent me home. So the only thing you can do is go and get food. And at night, they're very vigorously patrolling the streets and yelling at anybody. I mean, it's not some sort of violent thing where like people are getting thrown into wagons or something, but they don't let you be outside at all.
Okay. And Dr. Steve Bickel, you are a practicing physician in Florida. Now, Florida is a state which has by itself a very large full-time population of senior citizens who are most at risk from COVID-19. But there's also a very large seasonal population in Florida, people known as snowbirds, who come down for the winter and they're still there for the winter season. So while the population density of Florida isn't quite the same as New York City or California, Florida is already becoming a hotspot for COVID-19 infections. Steve, please share with us, what's the perspective of healthcare professionals? It feels to me like you guys must be bracing for the really big storm to hit. Have the authorities provided you with the tools and supplies that you need, and how do healthcare workers see the situation?
Well, it almost feels like, you know, we're bracing for a hurricane. I mean, that's kind of the mood. It's like, you know, this unknown is coming. Don't know the extent of it. Could be really bad. People are making preparations, but, you know, you never know how well they're going to hold up when the storm hits. And I've been pleasantly surprised with state and local sort of proactivity to get ready. I think maybe they're heeding the message from New York and from Italy that, you know, it's that you can't deny this is a major threat. The last week, it's just been this escalating, rolling process of like one thing being closed, another thing being closed. The latest, the city I'm in just went into, you know, kind of a lockdown recommendation like Italy's, you know, just don't go out of the house except for essentials. So, you know, it's going pretty fast. I'm actually pleasantly surprised. Because like my county has one case reported so far, you know, albeit there's been limited testing, but still, you know, the numbers have been pretty small. But we just had spring break in Florida. You know, my next door town is Daytona. They just had Bike Week with, like, you know, thousands and thousands of people from all over the country. You know, not the greatest timing. So it's a little scary because it is such a big tourist area. But locally, the health departments have been very proactive. The hospitals, I mean, they've got contingency plans. It's just you don't know what the extent of it. It's like, you know, Mike Tyson's phrase, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. And you just don't know. I mean, there have been orders for all sorts of backup equipment, 5 mobile intensive care units, hundreds of thousands of, you know, masks and protective equipment from there's apparently some kind of federal repository, but that may be getting used up too. So there's a lot of preparation going, but things really haven't happened that much yet. You know, there's one case in our local hospital. So it's just really kind of an unknown now. I think we're a week or two away from things getting really, really more active.
I want to follow up now on a topic that we touched on in last week's COVID-19 podcast. I personally have been sick with something, not sure what, since really 3 weeks, starting on March 1st, so just over 3 weeks now. I woke up on that day with a 38 Celsius fever, swollen glands, dry, scratchy throat that felt like it wanted to turn into a cough, but fortunately, it only turned into a very mild cough in my case, and a sense of general malaise. Now, I was very fortunate at that time to have the opportunity to speak to some more Macro Voices listeners, a husband and wife team, very, very well qualified. She is a degreed epidemiologist. He is a practicing physician. And after medical consultation over the phone, the doctor said he really did not think that I had COVID-19. He thought it was more likely a common cold or some other kind of virus. But when my symptoms persisted beyond 2 weeks, I described them on last Wednesday's COVID-19 podcast. Then, Steve, I had the opportunity to talk to you. Thank you so much for the phone consultation you gave me. You concurred with the other doctor. You listened in detail to the symptoms I'd experienced. You said, Eric, I don't think you got COVID-19. I think it's something else. Needless to say, that was very reassuring to me. But then something really interesting happened, which is we got dozens of tweets and emails from listeners all over the world. One guy in Ireland, another one in the next town over from that nursing home in Illinois, several from Australia, a couple of them from South America, a couple of them from different parts of Europe. And they were all almost identical. What they said is, hey, I've got exactly the same symptoms you experienced. A few days of fever. I got scared. I thought it was COVID-19, but the fever didn't last. I figured it wasn't. But here's the thing, Steve. They all said the same thing. They said, what I experienced was, after my other symptoms went away, I felt this tightness of the chest or heaviness on the chest, maybe labored breathing. Some of them said that. Some of them just said it was like a tightness of the chest. But they all described a sensation of a persistent burning sensation directly under the sternum in the center of the chest that some of them said lasted for weeks after their other symptoms disappeared. And the thing is, I didn't really emphasize that burning sensation, particularly in the podcast, but almost everybody that wrote emphasized that one thing, which is very much consistent with my present symptoms. All the other flu symptoms have gone away, but I still have this persistent burning in the chest sensation. Steve, you've commented before off the air when I've talked to you that, you know, I might not be a medical person, but my skills as a speculator to catch on to a trend are pretty good. I can tell you something's going on here. There's something fishy about this. Doesn't mean I've got COVID-19, but if I don't, it means a whole bunch of people around the world inexplicably are experiencing burning in our chests. Lenore, you got sick in January, so I want to check in with you. How did your symptoms compare to mine? And particularly, did you experience this tightness of the chest and burning sensation? And if you did, how long did that last?
Definitely, yes. We had my group of friends and colleagues in Italy. We all got sicker in January than any of us have had in years and years and years. And I, particularly what was really strange for me is I have not had a fever in, the last time I had one was literally 26 years ago. I just don't get fevers for some reason. And my normal body temperature is pretty low. I'm like 35.5 Celsius usually. And I had the same like 38.5 fever for about 5 days. And then had the really tight chest. I was taking Mucinex like crazy because I'd had a doctor tell me, like, if you get sick, you have to take that. So I was taking, I mean, not overdosing, but I was taking it and had that just, but I wasn't really coughing much. It was just, I couldn't really breathe. I was like that, like say 3-4 weeks later, I still, and I'm a decent athlete. I can run 6-7 miles. I get on a treadmill and I could not, I do it. Like walking up the stairs was just, dear God, I'm going to die. I had to like mentally prepare myself to walk up the stairs. And that happened for a month later. And that same kind of symptoms, every one of us had basically the same thing, had a really awful just chest thing, but not where you're coughing up a whole lot of stuff. You're just, you can't breathe. And the thought of moving requires a good half hour of contemplation to just get the willpower up to do it.
Well, and that's very consistent with my experience. I have a treadmill at home. And since I'm not going out now, you know, you'd think I'd be using the treadmill. I can't put my finger on it, but something intuitively tells me, no, don't do this. As much as I need exercise, I do not want to exert myself. Dr. Steve, something doesn't add up here. Now, it's not just you and the other MD I mentioned. I also got 2 or 3 emails from listeners, MDs, who said, hey, listen, sorry you're not feeling well, but based on what you described on the podcast, I really do not think you have COVID-19. That's what they're saying. That's what the first MD I spoke to said. That's what you told me. Yet, at the same time, we've got all of these listeners from all over the world who all have a burning sensation in our chests that we've never had before. Quite a few people that wrote in said the same thing, which is, I've been sick many times, but I never had a sensation like this one. And that's very much my own experience. So there seems to be strong agreement among the doctors that the symptoms we're describing are not COVID-19. But at the same time, something's going on here. People all over the world are writing in with the same symptoms and emphasizing this burning sensation in the chest and tightness or heaviness, which none of us have ever experienced before. So that can't be chance probability. Something's going on. If it's not COVID-19, I guess it's plausible that there's some other virus sweeping the entire globe that's affecting people from Australia to Ireland to South America to Europe, but that's kind of hard to believe. So what do you make of this? How should we interpret this, Steve?
You know, this is an interesting question, and I think we can use it to talk about what somebody should do when they have symptoms, you know, how they should manage it themselves. But It's pretty complex because you could approach it on so many levels. First level is most symptom complexes are not so clear cut for one illness or one, you know, cause of illness, like that you can tell for sure. So the first time we talked, I told you I was pretty convinced it wasn't COVID based on the symptom grouping. That, you know, there was more of this tracheobronchitis than pneumonia, which is more, you know, consistent with COVID. And then I backed off a little because I'd looked at some of the symptoms. And actually, there haven't been many studies of this. You know, in the next year, it might emerge that there's several studies looking at, you know, groupings of symptoms. But that's never an absolute. It's always points you in one direction or another, because certain viruses tend to go to certain parts of the body, like they might go to the nose or more to the throat. You know, they really home in on certain areas. So with COVID, they really do go into the lower lungs. You know, that's how you get pneumonia. And there's a specific receptor, this ACE2 receptor, that's thought to be involved in their, you know, homing in there. So on that level, you couldn't tell for sure. That's why we do tests to confirm, you know, it could be 1 of 3 or 4 possibilities. And then you kind of narrow it down. But there are tons of viruses that cause these kinds of infections. It's just that now everybody's thinking about COVID. So they, you know, but this stuff goes on. I mean, the symptoms you described, with the exception of the burning, I see all the time. So the burning it's a little unusual. And it may reflect some particular pathophysiology of COVID that we find out later that's a characteristic kind of thing. Now, but the other thing that comes up that's actually, you know, with your situation, there were 2 things that I was actually more concerned with. One was you were 18 days into the course of it when we talked. So chances of you having any virus in your system at that time were really quite low, like less than 10%. And there'd really be no need for treatment. The body had already taken care of it. So that was one issue. But the other one, which is probably even more important, is that, you know, I'm pretty sure you're familiar with Bayes' theorem. Because you probably use it investing-wise. But in medicine, it relates to a lot of how we interpret things, and that is that the prevalence of something in an area has a lot to do with what probability we're going to assign to the, you know, somebody's with a group of symptoms. So like if Lenore had this now in Italy, that would probably be number one on my list. But, you know, in January or early February, when there's hardly any of it around, or you think even with testing, there's probably not that much around, it just gets less likely. So you're trying to filter in this probability thing. So it's, you know, based on that, I'd say it just seems unlikely. But here's the thing. What did we know for sure? No. It really could be that COVID presents that way, that it's a characteristic sort of symptom complex that we find out some reason for later. But I was just kind of going through on sort of medical probabilities, and I think that's what the other docs were doing, that the symptom complex didn't quite fit. There's not much in your area. It just doesn't quite fit. But we might find out later that symptom complex is very specific for COVID and kind of recognizable.
Well, I want to run a hypothesis by you. And again, obviously, you know, the disclaimer is I'm not a medical person. I don't know what I'm talking about. But as a speculator who's good at thinking about probabilities and trying to evaluate things with partial information, what I see is people all over the world. I didn't stress the burning in the chest part on the podcast last week. They all stressed it in their emails. And they all said it's something that I've never had before. And it's very much my experience is, you know, this whatever I got sick with 2 or 3 weeks ago, that's over. But I still have the burning in the chest, and I've never experienced that before. I wonder if what's going on is these mild, we know that maybe as many as one third of COVID cases are completely asymptomatic, and those people are spreaders and they never know that they got sick. I'm wondering if what's going on is the symptoms of a mild COVID case are different from the initial symptoms of a serious COVID case. And that's kind of throwing the medical profession off. And maybe there's a silver lining in that cloud, because if the number of people that have had mild COVID cases is much larger than we think, and Lenore and I and all of these listeners that wrote in are part of it, presumably that means we're closer to herd immunity than we might have thought we were. Now, let me ask, first of all, Steve, I want to get your reaction as to whether there's any medical merit to what I just said. But I'm also curious, there's no testing where I am right now, but if testing, you know, drive-through testing became available, would it make sense for me still to go get tested? Or is it kind of too late where if the virus is gone, I would test negative, even if that's what I had weeks ago?
Well, currently with the tests we have now, your test would be negative. But in the future, and I hope we have this down the line, that antibody testing would be positive. So it would show that you had it, and then we could infer you're immune. So that would be useful in retrospect. But now, if you had it, if you had had it, the virus would be out of your system. I mean, almost 3 weeks, it's virtually no cases where they can still get virus out. There's an occasional one. So that's the answer in terms of testing, that it wouldn't be useful now with current tests. In the future, if I were you, I'd want to get that antibody test if it becomes available and find out if I did have it. Antibodies can take a month or two to show up after an infection to measurable levels. But the other question is, what about the mild to moderate cases? Is the symptom complex different? And really could be. I could only find one study of symptoms in COVID cases, and those were more serious. So that's kind of skewed. And that comes from just, you know, seeing people in the future, more mild cases, and they did kind of a retrospective analysis of the symptoms, or even prospectively, we might find out that there is kind of a characteristic pattern, and it's different than for the mild cases than the severe.
And if that's true, do you think there's a chance that we're closer to herd immunity than we thought otherwise?
That would mean that. It'd mean two things. One, it would mean that there may be, the death rate may be lower because the, you know, we have a bigger denominator for infections. But the second one is that, yeah, that would matter. I don't think that's going to turn out to be the case, but because I think a lot of these, I mean, there's just a lot of viral illnesses every year. They just go around the globe, and there's just so many of them in the background. I mean, you know, most people get like one cold a year, and of that, you know, maybe a tenth of them are this more severe kind that we talked about, where it actually goes into the chest, not just the throat.
On that note, you know, for the benefit of our listeners, anybody who gets sick with anything, in this environment is going to have the same experience Lenore and I had, which is, hey, wait a minute, you know, probably this is not this COVID thing, but what if it was? So there's lots of information already out there for the benefit of people who are coming down with serious COVID cases. You know, when you have a high fever that lasts for several days and you have extreme coughing and the other symptoms that are associated with COVID-19, call your doctor, you know, take action. But for people who are experiencing mild symptoms where maybe it's COVID or maybe it's just some rhinovirus, something else that's going on, what would your guidance be, Steve, for those people to sort of sort out what they should do and at what point? Because, you know, there's a big risk of engaging with healthcare right now. If you go and wait in the waiting room, you're probably going to have it by the time you're done if you didn't have it when you walked in. So you don't want to go to the doctor unless you really need to. But at the same time, if you're sick with anything, I can speak from experience. It's very challenging emotion to be, you know, I hope it's not COVID-19, but what if it was? So what should people do?
That's a great question, Eric. So what would I do? Let's look at it that way. First thing is I'd self-isolate, because whether I have a cold or COVID, whether I can get tested or not, I don't want anybody to get what I have. And if there's no way of being tested, then you don't know. And there's the possibility that really is COVID and you could give it to somebody. So that's the first thing. Secondly, is there any treatment at this time that's clearly effective? No. There are some suggestions of possible treatments, and then that could change the game. But so I'd just be treating myself symptomatically. And then the third thing I'd be looking for, which is actually what they're kind of using to screen people for different stages of COVID to put them into studies, is shortness of breath. And you could, if you wanted to get, you know, I don't want to start a run on this, but, you know, we use these little handheld oximeters you stick on your finger, and they give a recording of what your oxygen level is. The general cutoff is like 94%. Most people run 97, 8, 9. Below 94 is thought to be, if you don't have pre-existing lung disease, a sign that, you know, it's really starting to affect your ability to get deliver oxygen to your blood. I'd probably get one if I was worried about it. You can get them for about $20 online. And I'd probably have one just as one of my little, you know, devices to measure. I mean, I use them myself for patients, but to just have at home to measure. And then if my oxygen started getting, if I'm getting short of breath, and my oxygen level confirms it's at, you know, 93, 94, something like that, then I'd probably start getting really concerned and consider going, you know, for a medical evaluation, because those are the people that often need to be hospitalized.
Those devices are still available. I can speak from experience, having just ordered one in the last few days. If you go on Amazon and just search for oxygen tester, you'll find them for about $20. And mine is on its way to me. So I'll let you know, Steve, when I get an oxygen reading after it arrives. Lenore, I want to come back to the situation in Italy. Now, on Saturday, Italy reported 6,557 new cases in just one day and really freaked people out with 793 new deaths. The thing that is getting a lot of attention is that fatality rate in Italy, which is now worse than China, if you're believing the numbers. Of course, a lot of people don't trust China's numbers. But, you know, it's also worse than nearby Germany, which reported 2,516 new cases on Saturday, but only 84 new deaths on Saturday. So is Italy got a more deadly strain of this, or is there some other explanation for why Italy seems to have a higher death rate than other countries?
Well, as you can imagine, that's been a major discussion point here. And there's a couple of things that have come out about it. One is what Italy is calling the COD, the cause of death. So in Italy, they're basically coding anything as a coronavirus if the person had it. I mean, they'd actually gone in and had patients who had passed away and tested them after the fact to see if they had coronavirus. And so if you come anywhere near coronavirus, that's going to be the COD. Germany is only doing it if the person who passed away has no other pre-existing conditions. So if this person has some sort of a lung problem, they have heart disease, what have you, they're not coding it as coronavirus. And I understand that that's similar to what's been going on in China. The other theory that has been talked about by doctors here. So this isn't the media speculation. This is actually going on with the doctors who are leading the care here, is, to your point about possibly being a bit higher, that the number of people infected is far higher than the numbers would indicate, so that our death rate actually is in line with everyone else. It's just Italy had so many more cases earlier. Because one of the things that they've identified is that we may have had something very similar to what South Korea had with the so-called super spreader, right? I think it was patient 31 super spreader who infected so many people at that. There was a religious event in Italy. We had a game between the team from Bergamo and the team from Valencia, Spain. It's a huge soccer tournament. Such a big soccer tournament that it couldn't be hosted in Bergamo. So they had it in Milan. So you have these two massive teams meeting in Milan, and they have traced a lot of cases back to that match. And then that is what has led to so many cases in Milan and Bergamo. Bergamo's got the worst cases, and also in Spain. So it's another theory going about.
I want to talk about something that really got my attention on the internet in the last few days, and that is the video from the doctor in Spain. Now, Spain is on track almost to be as bad as Italy, but not quite yet. And this doctor was literally crying in the YouTube video that he made, and he explains in Spanish that basically they've reached the point where what they're doing is anybody who's over 65 who's in the ICU is being disconnected from the ventilators and being given sedatives so that they will die more peacefully to make the ventilator equipment available to younger people who have longer to live. And first of all, that's just a horrific humanitarian situation. But you know, I don't want to scare anybody. I've been accused of fear-mongering before. I'm not trying to panic anyone, but I do think that it makes sense for us to objectively analyze what's going on. And Steve particularly, but both of you, because Lenore, you've lived through this in Italy, something I don't think Americans are in touch with is everybody seems to have this attitude of, well, you know, America's exceptional. This can't happen to us. This is a virus that doesn't discriminate. And as I understand it, Italy had a higher number of hospital beds on a per capita basis than the United States has. The United States is still weeks behind Italy in terms of the exponential growth projection. But frankly, the U.S. is, in my opinion, making a lot of policy mistakes. They've got guidance that, you know, President Trump says he doesn't approve of what these spring breakers are doing, partying in on the beaches of Florida, but they're not doing anything to intervene and stop it. And I'm concerned that it seems inevitable to me, I'll go ahead and use that word, even though I'm sure I'll be criticized for it, that what's coming for the United States is the same experience, where eventually, I don't think it would be everywhere in the country, but in many local areas where the outbreaks are the worst, it will become necessary to triage to the point of cutting people off and allowing them to die in order to save younger people. Steve, you're the expert on the medicine. Please tell me there's something I'm missing, and there really is a reason that that's not possible in the United States.
I wish I could say that. I think we're just, it's just kind of beyond people's comprehension. And so until it happens, they just can't believe it. I think it, you know, looking at the numbers, looking at that Imperial College report, looking at what's happened in Italy, it's starting to happen in New York. I think it's very possible, and I can't disagree with you at all.
Lenore, based on what you're seeing in Italy, what's your perspective? And I think Italy has already been through this. Maybe there was no crying doctor on YouTube, but I believe that the similar circumstances happened already.
Yeah, we didn't have somebody videotaping quite as poignantly, but friends of mine who are doctors told us the very same thing, that they were daily forced. And we're hoping, it's looking like there's some improvement. We had a drop in numbers yesterday, but that also is related to they did fewer tests, got processed. So we're not really sure quite yet. But they have had to decide who they're going to try to help live and who they're going to simply let die because they don't have enough equipment to save everyone. And just to be really clear for everyone listening to this, this happened. The part of Italy that hit the hardest is the wealthiest part of Italy. It has some of the finest hospitals in Europe, some of the finest in the world. I mean, these are absolute world-class organizations that have the best equipment available. We're not talking about some area that's, you know, fairly poverty-stricken or really struggling. This is the best of the best, and thank God for that, because it hasn't really hit the south of Italy that is much poorer and has a much weaker infrastructure. So if it happened here, it definitely can happen anywhere in the United States. And yet we see people out on the beaches and just ignoring, because people just want to live their life and pretend like things haven't changed. And I understand that, but that behavior can be killing people that you care about.
Lenore, something I'm very concerned about in this whole story, and I don't think, I mean, it's gotten public attention, but not enough as far as I'm concerned. I think that healthcare workers are being set up here to be the martyrs in this story. And I know it's already happened in Italy. I'm afraid it's coming to the United States. Before I go to Steve, who's on the front lines, you've seen what went down in Italy. I'm not so much interested in the facts. I think people have seen those in the news. But what's been your personal experience in knowing healthcare workers, doctors and nurses who've been on the front lines? They don't have the personal protective equipment that they deserve. Somebody didn't plan ahead well enough. They're being separated from their families and friends, living in, as I understand it, dormitory conditions, because everybody knows they're being infected and their lives are being put at risk. They're expected to continue working to save everybody else while their lives are put at risk, and they don't even have new face masks for each new case they walk into. How is that affecting your friends who are doctors and nurses, and what is the morale report from what you've seen?
They're living a war, and the rest of the country now is appreciating that because of what the images we have seen in the news, on TV, on social media, that finally the rest of Italy understood what is going on. But they are living in a war zone, and the trauma from this is going to be substantial. We have many doctors who, and this, we have doctors who've come out of retirement to help protect, to help save, and they themselves have died. Imagine what that does to their friends and colleagues, to see somebody who was, you know, they'd done their bit and they've gone off to enjoy the rest of their life. They come back and they die for their efforts. And that is something that is going to scar the nation. I don't think people realize that the world is changed and it will never be what it was before this happened. We will never look at healthcare the same, and nor will we ever, I think, look at each other the same, because this fundamentally changes the way everything works.
Steve, you're on the front lines in Florida, and the hurricane is still a few miles offshore. You haven't hit the eye wall yet. I would really love to tell our listeners, hey, the good news is the United States is better prepared than Italy was, and it's going to be better. Frankly, from what I can see, I'm not a professional in your field. I don't know much about it. But from everything I can see, the United States is less prepared. As Lenore said, that happened in a region of Italy, which is basically the Beverly Hills of Europe. It's where the rich people live, and they have the best hospitals and the best equipment and everything. What's coming to the United States is going to hit all of the most densely populated areas hardest. So places like Detroit and Chicago and, you know, St. Louis are all going to be hit very hard with this. From what I understand, really, we're struggling just to order face masks. What do you foresee, and what's the mood of your peers as this storm approaches?
You know, it's such an unknown, Eric. It's like there's been a lot of preparation, but you just don't know what you're facing. You know, I don't do hospital work anymore. I just do outpatient. But so I'm not quite sure with what, you know, I get the reports all the time. I mean, they are really gearing up, and they have been for weeks. But, you know, like if you're trying to source material and there's nothing you can, you know, like the local hospital has been trying to source, you know, protective equipment worldwide. But you don't know where it is. Maybe all the sources are dried up. So it's very hard to say. You know, I think that the analogy to you know, doctors in the hospital dealing with this to soldiers is, I think, a very apt one. I mean, I saw an interview with one of the directors of one of the big hospitals. I think they call it National Research Hospital or something in northern Italy. It was a the Journal of American Medical Association editor interviewed him. This guy was a hero. I mean, it was touching, so dedicated. They had done amazing planning. I mean, they picked up on this like a week or two before it was even happening. There had been just a couple cases, and then they just got overwhelmed. I mean, and they had really prepared. I mean, they had emptied out beds and figured out ventilator availability, stopped the elective surgeries, you know, done a national kind of coordination or a regional coordination for how they'd route people around. I mean, it was you know, very impressive preparation. And, you know, Lenore described to you what happened to you despite that. So I think it's just, you know, that's happening in the medical front. On the societal front, I mean, I've been moderately pleased that Florida is moving fast. I mean, they, you know, just like last week, every day there was some escalation of the protective measures that they were doing. I mean, to now it's almost going to complete lockdown. I think I've heard from some of my health official friends that they think it's going to be statewide by the end of this week, but that's not confirmed at all. So they're moving quickly, but is it 2 or 3 weeks late? That's the hard question. These measures work? I was just reviewing some of the data, and it looks like there's about a 30-day lag between when you really do these heavy lockdown measures and when you start seeing the numbers drop. And so it's like we could be, you know, in for a really nasty month and longer if they don't, you know, really get to that full level of isolation and things like that.
Folks, we're recording this on Monday, midday. This morning, Monday morning, we had what I think was the biggest monetary intervention in central banking history. The Federal Reserve announced unlimited quantitative easing, including buying corporate bonds, which in my opinion undermines the spirit and intent of the Federal Reserve Act. They figured out a way to work around it by using a special purpose vehicle, but they're basically doing something that the Federal Reserve Act had intended to prohibit, which is buying corporate bonds. Biggest intervention to save asset markets in recorded history. It lasted less than 2 hours. News came out just after 8 o'clock, and by 10 o'clock Eastern time on Monday, we had already fully retraced the spike up, which was inevitable in asset prices in reaction to that announcement. As we're now speaking at just around noontime on Monday, we're plumbing new lows on the day in both S&P 500 futures and on crude oil. Lenore, it looks to me like the Fed put has completely expired, if it wasn't already expired last week. We just got a re-verification that no amount of monetary intervention is going to save markets. You're the global macro strategist for Thematica Research. How do you interpret all of this?
Well, I think first off, the Fed had to step into the corporate bond market because in the last 9 trading days last week, we had within 9 trading days, the iShares investment grade corporate bond ETF, ticker LQD, dropped to levels last seen in June of 2010. That means 10 years of gains were wiped out in 9 trading days. That's just wholly unprecedented. The S&P 500 had the longest consecutive days of 4%+ daily moves in history. The last 30 days, the S&P dropped 30%. That's the fastest ever, faster than the 1929 crash, faster than 1987. I mean, we're just in a whole new ballpark. And if you think about it, it makes sense because there is no bottom right now. We have no idea how much of the global economy is going to be completely shut down, and we have no idea for how long. So where are the fundamentals? The fundamentals are zero. And we're seeing what that means is this massive race into dollars. Because if you think about it, the one asset that has the biggest short position in the world is the US dollar. There's roughly $12 trillion, or about 60% of US GDP, in dollar-denominated debt around the world. And it's killing them. The Eurozone banks have already accessed a record level of dollar funding via the ECB last week, with a bigger uptake than occurred during the absolute worst of the 2008 crisis. So this morning, the Fed, 8 o'clock, announces, like you said, record actions. We've never seen anything like this. And the market was wholly unimpressed. I think what that move was was a last desperate attempt to establish some sort of a floor under asset prices. And I think the only place that they can go now, because we simply, we cannot watch the market, every single asset class crash to zero. I think the last move after this is going to be to close the markets until we get a better idea of the magnitude of the economic consequences of this global shutdown. And with that, I'm curious what there is, the potential is out there, because obviously a vaccine is a long ways away, but this whole problem goes away if we can significantly reduce the hospitalization rate. So if we can find some cocktail of existing drugs that does enough to take the edge off, so it's, we're not seeing like 15 to 30% hospitalization rates, depending on age group, we're seeing 5%, right? It would be a complete game changer. So is that out there? Is that a possibility? Can we hope?
Well, let's go back to Dr. Steve Bickel for that. And I want to expand it slightly. You said, what cocktail of drugs? Let's expand it to also include non-pharmaceutical interventions and anything else. Is there some medical breakthrough? It sounds like, basically, to summarize what Lenore is saying, the only way you save the economy here is you figure out how to bring down the hospitalization rate. Steve, what does it take to do that?
Let's say there was a medicine that you could give early on, like when you do with influenza, and it would drop the serious complication rate by 25%. That could be, you know, that could be a game changer. Is that possible? Well, there are a bunch of drugs out there with antiviral activity. In the past, most of the time, their effect is modest. I don't think 25% is out of the question. I mean, could it be more? Yeah, that'd be really fortunate. But hydroxychloroquine, the one that's getting some press, it drops the viral loads in the blood pretty rapidly. Whether that translates to clinical outcome differences, that's what's being studied right now. I think it's possible. I mean, there's four or five different drugs being looked at. There are collaborative studies going on nationally right now. I know I have some friends in Chicago, one of the big hospitals, and they're already involved in two or three drug studies. So I think we're going to see an outpouring of information in the next month to help answer that question. It's, like I said, it's possible. I'm not holding out great hope, just because in the past, the antiviral drugs for acute illnesses have had just kind of modest impacts, not like game-changing impacts.
Steve, Lenore, I really want to thank you for taking time out of your day today to help prepare this podcast for our listeners. We're going to leave it there in the interest of time. Before we close, I do want to mention a really, really important paper that I really want everyone to read. It's titled The Hammer and the Dance, and it doesn't really introduce any new research, but it's just a really well-written article that lays all of these concepts out in a way that anyone can understand. And the essential concept is there needs to be two things. One, the hammer means we really need to do something aggressive to contain this viral outbreak before it goes completely out of control. Mitigation by itself is not enough. We really have to look at lockdowns and containment. You do that for some period of time, which is kind of a debate. A lot of experts with a lot of different views as to how long you have to shut everything down in order to get the outbreak under control. Then the second part is called the dance. And the whole idea there is once you've got the outbreak under control, you want to start the economy back up again. But it's a dancing act to figure out how quickly you're able to start things. And the name of the game is keeping R0. That's the index which determines the transmissivity of the virus. You got to keep that below one, meaning that you're not increasing the number of people that have it. So it starts with the hammer, which is a great big lockdown that hopefully doesn't have to last too long. And then it's a dance to see how we can get the economy restarted. Really great article. Not a whole lot of new research, but a really fresh interpretation of what was already known and a particularly, I think, thoughtful writing style. You'll find the link to that article in the description of today's podcast on our homepage at macrovoices.com next to Lenore's picture. And you can also just find it by Googling Hammer and Dance. This episode of Macro Voices was sponsored by my own vacation rental on the coast of Maine. It's a 5-acre oceanfront family compound with a deep water dock, 2 separate residences, 2 kitchens, and 8 king and queen bedrooms. But with all the pull-out sofas and bunk beds, we can actually sleep upwards of 30 people in a pinch. You couldn't imagine a better safe haven to ride out the COVID-19 crisis than this property. It's extremely rural. You couldn't ask for better social distancing. And it features sunsets over the ocean and has a great big rec room with a pool table, home theater, and super fast 100 megabit cable internet to keep you connected to both Netflix and financial markets. I'd like to find a tenant for the duration of the COVID crisis. This property would be ideal for someone with a big family who wants to get out of New York City and ride the crisis out in the countryside. To be clear, this property is currently booked in July and August, so I'd have to renegotiate with my current reservations, but I don't think that would be too hard given the circumstances. Now, this is a big place, 5 acres of oceanfront, 2 residences, and accommodations for up to 30 people. So it's not cheap, $1,000 a night during high season. But if your family can afford to live in New York City or Boston, you can probably afford to get out of the city for this crisis, which I strongly recommend. If you're interested, please email me via info@macrovoices.com. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.